Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin for a free 30-day trial.
It's Common Sense with Dan Carlin.
Let me ask you something, and I don't think there's a right answer, so don't stress about it. But what do you think would happen if the United States changed its foreign policy in any meaningful way? I mean, look at how precariously the world seems balanced sometimes and how there's a global security framework for much of the planet, ingrained by over 50 years of enhanced tradition and interaction and cooperation and agreements and alliances. What do you think would happen if that system were questioned? And what do you think would be the reaction if somebody actually tried to alter that system in any meaningful way? And I don't just mean the reaction in terms of people who don't want it altered, but in terms of outcomes that might occur if it were altered. Let me tell you why I'm talking about this. Yesterday, John Kasich ended his campaign for the Republican nomination for president. The importance of this was magnified by the fact that the day before that, Ted Cruz did the same thing. And all of a sudden, regardless of whether he has that magical number you have to avoid a contested convention, there's only one guy who's still apparently running for the Republican nomination for president who's still there, Donald Trump. And I have to tell you, along with a lot of other people, I find the entire thing inconceivable. Inconceivable. And I was one of everybody else who was wrong about how far he would get in this thing. Part of what makes this next election, again, so now off the books in terms of the betting line, you can't even figure out what's going to happen, is I don't think we've had a non-politician get this far in the race for the White House, maybe ever. I mean, last 100 years, Wendell Willkie maybe in the 1940s. I mean, I don't know who you compare it to, but it makes this off the charts unusual, you know, right from that point on. Something else, though, makes this very unusual, and that's that Donald Trump is closer to the White House than anyone else who's brought these kinds of third-party or independent ideas with him to the race. I mean, this is like having, in some respects, depending on which issue you decide to pick on an a la carte basis, like having a Green Party nominee or a Libertarian Party nominee or someone like that getting to the point where it's they and one other candidate for all the marbles. Now, I've done shows recently where I've pointed out all the problems I have with Donald Trump. But here's the thing. I've also pointed out that there are some things that Donald Trump is advocating, in a very broad sense, and details will differ person to person, of course, that almost every other third party and independent candidate you can think of over the past 30 years has been pushing broadly, re-examining the foreign policy. In this race alone, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders both advocate that. Paleocon Pat Buchanan, running for the Reform Party nomination, he advocated it, as did consumer protection guru and Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Libertarian darling Ron Paul advocated it, as did Jill Stein from the Green Party. I mean, you could go on and on. Almost by definition, it's the outsider parties that bring these kinds of things up, because the areas that generally the two major parties agree upon consists of these establishment priorities that are never questioned. Foreign policy is number one on the list. That's why there's a phrase, the bipartisan consensus on foreign policy. Sometimes it's the post-Second World War bipartisan consensus on foreign policy, where the credible people in the Democratic and Republican Party, even though they may differ on specifics, broadly agree upon the way things are. And as I said, the way things are more than 5 decades in the making, and the longer it goes without changing, the harder it would be to change. How do you break something like what we have with NATO down to a different level? It's extraordinarily hard to even imagine, isn't it? And we haven't been talking about it because it's unrealistic to imagine it happening. Just like it's inconceivable to imagine Donald Trump making it this far in the presidential campaign. But he has, and all of a sudden this subject that was too esoteric and unrealistic to even discuss is one of the things that this guy who's this close to the White House is promising to do. Might be time to start talking, right? I should also point out that, listen, this guy's promised to do a lot of things. He can't do them without the help of other people, mostly, though. If he's going to build a wall keeping Mexicans out, and he can't get Mexico to pay for it, he's going to have to get Congress to do that. They control the purse strings, and they can shut him down there, can't they? So there's a lot of things Trump's promising that he might not be able to deliver on, but the president's got broad power in foreign policy, don't they? I mean, theoretically, this is a guy who could probably start a war by himself, power-wise. I mean, if you're talking about, does he have the power? I think he does. Who's going to stop him? I mean, I've often wondered, have you ever thought about this? I've often wondered that there has to be, don't you think, sort of a shadow control in government inserted at some level. I mean, if Donald Trump decided after becoming president, you know, Vladimir Putin's getting uppity, I want to send him a message, let's nuke this Ukrainian town. Do you think that, and I'm scared regardless of which outcome happens, if he goes and tells the military to do this and they say, okay, that's scary. But if he tells the military to do it and they go, sorry, no, we're not going to do it. Veto, you can't do that. That's a little scary too. A friend of mine who's in the military, I threw that at him once, and that's what he said. There was this long pause where I said to him, what would happen if Donald Trump launched a nuke to send a message to somebody? There was this long pause, and he said, the military wouldn't do it. And right there, you get to one of those crisis points. It's interesting to speculate about, but it does make you wonder. I mean, we've had very intelligent people in the halls of our government over the past 50-plus years. You have to imagine at some point somebody came up with a fail-safe plan in case the president lost his mind or something. But it's not something we know about. As far as you can tell by looking at it legally, I don't believe there's anything that keeps a president from deciding, I'm going to launch a nuclear weapon if I want to. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, obviously, it would be a tough thing to do, and there'd be a heck of a lot of flack afterwards, but I'm not sure that, at least if you look at the tree of powers anymore, that there's any check to that power. Again, it's all theoretical, and who would ever abuse it? I mean, it doesn't matter if Mitt Romney or Barack Obama wins the, you know, last election we had. Either one of them can be trusted in that situation. Well, all of a sudden now, go to some of these liberal message boards out there. All of a sudden, there's some people thinking, oh my God, when did we think it was a good idea to have such exalted foreign policy powers for the president? Because Trump's going to have them. Well, I give it about a 30 to 35% chance anyway. So what happens if Donald Trump decides that he's going to follow through on this promise to, you know, take a close look and maybe realign the foreign policy? Well, I thought about this a little bit because, as you might imagine, Bernie Sanders is probably going to have a very different idea of what realigning the foreign policy should consist of than Donald Trump, just like Pat Buchanan's would be very different reforming than Ralph Nader. It's all very easy in a political sense when somebody says, I don't like the way things are, so let's change it, and I'm for changing it. It's very easy for all of us to go, I'm for changing it too. That's a great idea. When people start explaining how they will change it, that's when support can start to peel off. So the devil's always in the details. But if we look at this issue right from the start, I would like to suggest, once again, you know, I've said that there are some positive advantages that our system has reaped, you know, whatever you might think of Trump, because he ran. I think the last year has been like a giant civics lesson for a large number of American voters, and they will carry that experience and knowledge of how the system works with them for the rest of their voting lives. Hard to quantify what the value of that is, but I would suggest it's not insignificant. So there's one thing right there. I think Trump has helped expose the kabuki theater scripted nature of what American politics has become in a way that helps to demystify it and in some ways make it harder to get away with. Again, part of that is also the education of the electorate. Once they understand a little bit more about these things, they're harder to, you know, have the wool pulled over their eyes. So I think those are beneficial things too. I would also like to suggest that if Trump can get these issues, like whether or not the current foreign policy approach, which has been the approach for a long time, as I said, is really, you know, still working for us, or if something like this is fundamentally overdue for a certain level of reform, if we can just have this conversation, if the reality that somebody with Trump's foreign policy reform ideas is this close to the White House prompts a conversation based in some sort of reality, again, that's a positive side effect, I think, right there. And if we're going to be able to have a discussion, the first thing we're going to have to do is demystify and, let's be honest, disempower some of these terms that are used to shut down the debate up until this point. There's a reason we don't have this debate right now. It's because you can easily be tarred with the label like isolationist And that is not an argument in a debate. That's a dead end that ends the debate because it makes you and marks you out to be an outlier whose ideas are so utopian that they shouldn't be taken seriously when we're talking about a serious foreign policy debate. Here's the problem. To many of these people who use that term, the definition of an isolationist is anyone who wants less intervention than what we have right now. And I think what drives me the most crazy about the term is it's a patently absurd term, so I can't figure out why it's been so effective at shutting down debate. I mean, what is an isolationist? An isolationist country is like North Korea. People here who are being tarred with the isolationist label are people simply asking for a somewhat higher standard, you know, in terms of when we decide our interests are threatened enough to send people to war. How can anything that's less interventionist than what we have now fall into the same general isolationist category? And how, by advocating a foreign policy that is almost like every other country's foreign policy, can you be called an isolationist? The truth is, and I think it's clear to everyone, we're hyper-interventionist right now. Some people are calling for something as simple as lowering the bar from a country that is hyper-interventionist to one that is merely just run-of-the-mill interventionist. How could you call that an isolationist? So first of all, let's go over a little bit. There's a piece by Maureen Dowd. She writes for the New York Times, but this appeared in my local paper on May 5th, 2016. We'll start with her. And she contrasts Donald Trump with Hillary Clinton. And in that comparison, Trump comes off as the dove and Hillary Clinton as the hawk, the military hawk. And she says, yes, 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 Trump will talk tough about ISIS and torture and everything else. But when it comes to foreign policy, he's more of a dove than Hillary. Here's what she says about Trump from the middle of the piece. In my local paper, The Register Guard, it was entitled, "It's No Joke, Hillary the Hawk versus Donald the Dove." And near the end of the piece about Donald Trump, it says, quote, "He can sound belligerent, saying that he would bomb the expletive deleted out of ISIS, and he would think up new and imaginative ways to torture terrorists and kill their families. But he says that in most cases, he would rather do the art of the deal than shock and awe. Quote," this is Trump talking, "unlike other candidates for the presidency, war and aggression will not be my first instinct," he said in his maiden foreign policy speech in Washington. Quote, "A superpower understands that caution and restraint are really truly signs of strength," end quote. And then Dowd writes, "This had the neocons leaping into Hillary's muscular embrace," end quote. Now, to see how the isolationist slur is used to shut down any opinions other than the current establishment view of the foreign policy, you have to turn to someone like Charles Krauthammer, who's a professional at this. He will tie it into both communists and Nazis and people that were too blind to foresee Pearl Harbor. He'll slam left and right wingers who believe this stuff as either people who hate foreigners or people who hate Americans. And I mean, this is the perfect example of all the slurs put together, and you get a very clear idea of the way that people who want to frame any talk of foreign policy changing can do this and how they can marginalize anyone who brings this up. So this Krauthammer piece appeared in the Washington Post. I got it out of my local paper Monday, May 2nd, 2016. The headline in my local paper is "Trump's Foreign Policy, an Inconsistent Jumble." And so now listen to the way Krauthammer basically takes anybody who doesn't approve of the current way we do things in foreign policy and ridicules them and writes them off and marginalizes them. Krauthammer's talking about President Obama and basically saying that he's an American firster who won't use the term, and so is Trump. So he writes, quote, "The irony is that while President Obama would never use the term, it is the underlying theme of his foreign policy, which Trump consistently denounces as a series of disasters. Obama, like Trump, is animated by the view that we are overextended and overinvested abroad." Quoting Obama now, quote, "The nation that I'm most interested in building is our own," declared Obama in his December 2009 West Point address on Afghanistan. Krauthammer continues, quote, "This is also the theme of Bernie Sanders. No great surprise, left and right isolationism have found common cause since the 1930s. Socialist Party leader Norman Thomas often shared the platform with Charles Lindbergh at America First rallies. Both the left and the right, he writes, have a long history of advocating American retreat and retrenchment. The difference is that liberals want to come home because they think we're not good enough for the world. Conservatives want to wash their hands of the world because they think the world is not good enough for us. End quote. Now, what Krauthammer's not pointing out there is, if you're going to get into this who's the good American sort of point of view of this whole thing, the fact that this country has a long history and a public opinion that in general tends to favor the idea of minding our own business and concentrating on our own affairs. We also have this tendency to want to see our tax dollars spent at home, and in general don't much like the idea of being the policeman of the world. So who the heck is Krauthammer writing off when he talks about that kind of an attitude? I mean, there's a lot of Republican voters who just voted for Donald Trump. Hard to figure out on a case-by-case basis how many of them really, really voted for him for his foreign policy ideas. But it's interesting seeing, even at this late stage, the attempts to try to avoid a rational discussion on how the foreign policy is doing, and if we don't like the way it's doing, what our options might be. Now, if you're a guy like Trump as a businessman, maybe you approach it from the standard of effectiveness. I have a feeling that if you throw that in somebody's face, that's a hard one to argue against because, you know, I'm reading, and I think I recommended it as an Audible book, Andrew Bacevich's new work on the Middle East and the U.S. involvement in there since 1980. And, you know, I lived through that, so I remember the newspapers and every day reading the stories, but he puts it into a wonderful context with analysis and hindsight built in a way that really helps you see. I think he said, and I'm quoting from memory, so it's probably wrong, he said something like, before 1980, no United States service personnel had been killed in the Middle East, and after 1980, none were killed anywhere else. And when he shows you, you know, what happened on a case-by-case basis, it's easy to see how we get sucked into one bad decision after another, but it's hard to deny that when taken as a whole, it's a lot of bad decisions. And if you say to yourself, if these bad decisions are a result of our general foreign policy approach, would it just make common sense, we would say here on this program, would a neo-prudentist foreign policy not suggest that some sort of a review is in order based on how it's working out? Or do the people that shut down any discussion of changing the way we do things by, you know, labeling opponents isolationists and whatnot really wish to never be able to, you know, tweak what we're doing based on what's working? I mean, are we essentially locking ourselves into something that doesn't work effectively or could work a lot better if we would simply be willing to be flexible enough to examine it? Now, here's the thing. With a guy like Krauthammer, he makes a living as a columnist. He pokes his opponents. It's what they do. But, I mean, this isolationist slur is used all through the media and in ways where I'm sure that the authors maybe don't even know any better. It's just in their mind's eye, anyone who's for a less interventionist foreign policy is an isolationist. It's become a tag. So I had this CNN story, and it's on Donald Trump's foreign policy ideas, and it's by, it appeared on the CNN Politics website Wednesday, April 27th, 2016. The headline is Donald Trump's Foreign Policy, America First, by Jeremy Diamond and Stephen Collinson. And listen to when the word isolationist crops up from the middle of the piece, quote, "But Trump often lacked specifics, delivering little in the way of a recognizable foreign strategy and repeating many of his campaign trail declarations, and did not explain in detail how his ideas would be implemented or touch on the likely response from American allies and enemies to his sharp reorientation of U.S. global principles. In comments likely to cause shockwaves among U.S. friends in Europe and Asia," he writes, "Trump previewed early attempts to cut deals with Russia and China, seen by many adversaries as bent on overthrowing the current security order guaranteed by America. If there was not a good deal to be had," Trump warned, "he would be prepared to walk away. But he also said he would not rush to war, striking an isolationist note that contrasts with the latest Republican administration of George W. Bush," end quote. Since when is someone who suggests he won't rush to war an isolationist? How is that an isolationist note? Who the heck rushes to war? Does everyone who's not an isolationist rush to war? It's the silliest dang excuse I've ever heard. It's patently absurd. So how does it work so well as a slur? So maybe that's the part that upsets me. I don't mind being slurred like that. I mind that it works so well when it's such a pathetic one. Come up with something better, would you, to discredit my whole way of talking about reform? I have no idea what Donald Trump would like to do in terms of reforming foreign policy. I've heard him say some things about NATO. I've heard him say some things about having allies carry more of the load. I will say that if you're looking at this from the perspective of how it could actually be done and what we're even talking about here, I mean, in my mind, and this is how isolationist I am, in my mind, I just want the bar to have to be higher for when we go to war. I think we use force too quickly, and I think we're too willing to. Does that mean you don't use force to defend your interests? No, but I do think you pare down your interests a little bit so that, you know, anything that happens anywhere in the world doesn't automatically qualify as your interest. Once upon a time, if something were in a faraway place that really seemed a long way away from your hometown, it was probably not your concern. Nowadays, the United States has military commands, I think, on every continent on the planet, almost. Why? Well, because we are the global provider of order. We are the spider in the center of the world's security framework web. We spend, as many people point out all the time, as much as the next, well, I've seen different numbers everywhere, say 5 or 10, somewhere in there, the next 5 or 10 powers put together. I think any common sense-oriented business person is going to look at that and say, now, wait a minute, how's this working out for us? We're spending all this money. How's it working out? And if you want to see, by the way, folks, how much things are different, go online and search out some of the major navies in the world and go check. I mean, Wikipedia will have entries on them, but you could see Jane's fighting ships. I mean, there's places that you can go see how the navies of the world are structured right about now. And the thing, if you're a military history guy like I am, that you're going to notice is, oh my God, they're small. Take just the surface fleets. They are tiny. They are minuscule. I mean, it's really unbelievable when you look at something like the Royal Navy, right? One of the traditionally greatest navy in the world. You look at how few actual surface ships they have. It will blow your mind. The idea that Britain can actually do what it does with that few ships is mind-boggling. But then go look at the U.S. Navy and realize that the U.S. Navy would beat the entire world put together at sea. The entire world. Maybe with one hand tied behind its back. If you are a corporate CEO and your company has that level of excess capacity, you might wonder if all of the money spent in that particular direction was actually well spent. These are the kind of things that don't necessarily have obvious answers sitting in front of you, but to go after people who bring the question up and who would like to see some more debate on this, I think is interesting. Again, I think it, in a very weird way, relates to their lack of confidence that they can win this argument. If the argument is out in the open and fair and we're not slurring, opponents of the idea so that we never have to take seriously what they have to say. I think if you want to talk about practical problems, though, you have to talk about a world right now that depends on the United States to a degree that makes it hard to not play the role we're playing in right now. I mean, if we looked at the foreign policy alignment of the United States and decided we wanted less responsibilities, because truthfully, the size of our military and all of that is contingent upon what we needed to do. And right now, what we needed to do is a huge task. If you decided to cut that task down, the question is then, how would the rest of the world deal with that? For example, if you could take a poll in the countries of all of our allies and ask them sort of like a restaurant does when the waitress leaves you your bill and they'll leave you a little thing saying, how was our service? Rate how nice we were, how hot the food was, and all these any ways we could improve. I mean, if you could do a poll in the countries of our allies and ask them those sorts of questions about our foreign policy, it would be fascinating to see what their thoughts were. I would also be fascinated to see how it differed country to country. I mean, do the Japanese have a very different view of our foreign policy and how we're doing than the Australians do? I mean, I think I'd be fascinated by all of it. But I think, I'm just assuming here, I bet you'd find two frames of mind. I think you'd find one that involved people that see the U.S. the way people in America right now see politicians we've seen too much of on television, where you just think, okay, enough already. You're everywhere. You're in our face all the time. You know, if we saw a little less of you, it'd be a good thing. Absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? Go low for a while. I mean, I could see people who feel that way, and I could see people that feel like the devil they know is better than the devil they don't know, and while they may not be particularly happy with the U.S. security framework as it exists, they can pretty much decide that they would like it less if it went away or diminished in importance. For example, if some of these countries had to start spending more on defense, I mean, as I said, look at the naval capability of these powers. Navies are expensive. I mean, how would you like to be a country that really doesn't need a navy right now because there's the U.S. Navy, and all of a sudden Donald Trump comes in and says, oh, we're not going to be patrolling this area. You can't count on us to be here if X, Y, or Z happens, so just make sure you can take care of it yourself. It's right offshore for you. You might have to go spend some money on a navy. You might turn around one day and say, you know what? It's not worth it. All we have to do, I'd rather have the U.S. with their foreign policy that's not perfect in my mind than to have to deal with the uncertainty of what would happen if we had to live without it. So a polling result would be very interesting to find out what our allies think. If you're going to do this for real, think about what this requires, because think about what will happen. If you're trying to keep the U.S. from having to be the policeman of the world, you have to imagine that a major international incident breaks out and the United States isn't there to deal with it. I've always thought that there's a bit of a cop-out with the fact that the U.S. is a little like the only homeowner on the street that has a fire hydrant and a fire hose. And when a fire breaks out anywhere in the street, the U.S. is almost responsible to go deal with it because they're the only ones with the fire hose and the water. U.S. capabilities are so far beyond the rest of the world that sometimes we're the only ones that can intervene in these places where horrific things are happening. I mean, if some sort of intertribal genocidal violence breaks out again in some area of Africa, for example, they start hacking an ethnic minority to death with machetes again, and a million people are going to die in a month if the world doesn't move on this. Is the world going to be looking at the Dutch for the yay or nay on that deal? Or are they going to, you know, wonder what Hungary's going to do, or India? Any one of those nations, by the way, might pledge significant help and might get involved and happy to pitch in and all that kind of stuff, but the nation that has the capability is going to be the nation that has veto power or go power in a deal like this. It puts a unique sort of responsibility on the United States, because if the United States decides, no, we're not going to go, and these European countries, even if they wanted to, can't now, how much does that then genocide rest on the shoulders of America? On the other hand, does that mean you're now morally obligated any time a potential genocide breaks out to get involved? Because after all, you know, it's like letting that neighbor's house burn down when you had a fire hose. In other words, does having the fire hose now obligate us to this kind of foreign policy? Is it a tail wagging the dog kind of situation? I've had Europeans and Americans make this into a moral argument when we discuss it. Morally, the U.S. has to act. We have the capability. We have the will. I mean, I'll give you an example of how much it drives me crazy. And it might not drive you crazy like it does me. So I fully acknowledge that. In the 1990s, I specifically remember Madeleine Albright. She was the United States ambassador to the UN under the Clinton administration. And then she got the Secretary of State job under the Clinton administration. And she would make these statements that were widely believed, and it's widely felt, you know, and people agree upon this in the national security establishment and the bipartisan consensus on foreign policy groups. This is all sort of how they think. You don't normally hear it enunciated quite so openly. And when you do, it either strikes you as weird or it doesn't. And you can maybe sort of test yourself based on how you react to this. But the first thing that she said that has always stuck in my mind, and I had to go to like Wikiquote to get the exact quote perfectly. So she's talking about the long-running issues with Saddam Hussein and Iraq and no-fly zones and use of force and all this kind of stuff. And she brings up a phrase. I don't think she invented it. I think I seem to remember it for a very long time. I hope my memory is correct. But the phrase is indispensable nation, right? The U.S. is this singular entity, the one that, you know, makes these decisions, the spider in the center of the web of the global U.S.-centric security framework. I mean, obviously, Russia's not part of that. China's not part of that. But a ton of the rest of the world is. You got NATO, you got CETO, you got tons of other alliances and regional connections and relationships with other rulers and their militaries. And Albright said, quote, "It is the threat of the use of force against Iraq," is what she meant, "and our lineup there that is going to put force behind the diplomacy. If we have to use force, it is because we are America. We are the indispensable nation. We stand tall, and we see further than other countries into the future, and we see the danger here to all of us. End quote. You know, I sit there and think to myself, we do? And we've assigned ourselves that role, or we gave our allies one of those questionnaires and said, how are we doing? What do you think? Are we the indispensable nation? Do we stand tall? I mean, it's an arrogant as hell statement, isn't it? We stand tall and see farther than other countries into the future. So you should trust us, not just with the fact that we'll help protect you, but we also know what's good for you in terms of, you know, where the outcomes of these various interventions and whatnot are going to be. Once again, I would call your attention to exactly how well our interventions and whatnot have worked to achieve our foreign policy goals of, let's just say, stability. So our track record sucks pretty bad. And yet in the 1990s, we were proclaiming, you know, our Secretary of State was proclaiming that we stand tall and see further than other countries into the future. And we see the danger here to all of us. Okay. The next thing she said that drove me crazy, because once again, I kept asking myself why we were in the position to be in this position. She was talking to Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes, and Stahl had brought up the number of Iraqi children that were allegedly who died as a result, one way or another, of sanctions against Saddam Hussein. Now, I don't believe that number, just me personally. I think that's an inflated number, and I think they used all kinds of things that were very dubious, but it doesn't matter. We can pretend it's a large number regardless. So she said 500,000. Let's pretend it's 200,000. What drove me crazy was that our Secretary of State basically got to make this sort of decision when the American people might have felt very different. Her answer to Leslie Stahl, here's what Leslie Stahl said. She said, quote, "We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And, you know, is the price worth it?" Meaning, is the price of keeping the sanctions on Saddam Hussein worth 500,000 children? The Secretary of State's answer was, quote, "I think it's a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it." End quote. Now, here's the thing. If you had asked Americans, let's just pretend again we're going with the number. We'll pretend the number's right, 500,000. If you had gone to Americans in the 1990s and said, it's going to cost 500,000 lives to keep these sanctions on Saddam Hussein, or we can drop the sanctions and figure out a different way to solve this problem, do you think the American people go, no, kill the 500,000 kids? I don't think there's any way that that would ever happen. But the Secretary of State, and of course the administration that she takes her orders from at the time, said they think the price is worth it. Now, in my opinion, maybe we can agree to disagree about that. That's fine. I would beg the question, though, why is that something we're involved with at all? Where that question of responsibility, weighing, you know, the deaths of 500,000 children, or something that we consider equally as important, so maybe we decide, yes, to accept the 500,000 children deaths. I don't know why we're in that situation. Why is that our call? Why do we have to take the risk of a huge, horrible, morally wrong decision there if we judge the situation mistakenly? Why is that our gig? And I think this is something that not just Trump, but third party and independent candidates have been asking for a long time, which is, if you're just one of the American people, how is the foreign policy working out for you? And I bring this up for a reason, because this whole foreign policy of ours is the result, as you might imagine, of a heck of a lot more than just asking a basic question like, what is a foreign policy for? That would be something that you would get in your high school textbook, wouldn't it? What is a foreign policy for? And you might have all these kinds of simplistic answers, but, you know, when you grow up a little bit, as you all have, and you see how the world works a little bit better, you realize that that's a question that will get a different answer depending on who you ask, right? If you want to get, I mean, it's called a magisterial book by reviewers, but what that really means is it's dense and comprehensive. But if you want to see laid out in wonderfully historical terms, exactly all the little strands of interest that play into how the United States is foreign policy and defense structure and all that sort of grew into what it is today. And I think in a totally non-biased way, by the way, just it's a wonderful synthesis that shows all the various interests operating from actual foreign policy concerns in a military realm to things like, you know, corporate procurement on, you know, how many bombers can we get into the Air Force? Well, maybe they don't want bombers anymore. Of course they want bombers. Send the lobbyists and tell them we still need bombers in the Air Force. I mean, all that kind of stuff. Go read In the Shadow of War, The United States Since the 1930s by Northwestern University historian Michael Sherry. And a book like that really lays out just how many different interests play upon society. I mean, I'll give you an example. When we talk about the problems with the corruption in the U.S. legal system here, and corporate money, for example, having such an influence on the way people vote, well, look at how that's impacting the foreign policy. So, for example, not that long ago, and I remember they made fun of it on The Daily Show because it's one of those stories you just can't believe, but we go ahead and do it anyway. The story involved a disagreement between the U.S. Congress and the military over the purchase of more tanks. The military basically saying that for our needs, we have enough tanks, thank you very much, and we actually have a bunch of them just, you know, in storage. We have more tanks than we need right now, but Congress voted for the tanks anyway because Congress had a different reason for wanting them. The military was looking at the mission and how many tanks they need. The Congress and their view of foreign policy isn't always about, you know, a typical foreign policy goal of extending the interests of the United States and defending and protecting them. Sometimes their goal is, I have jobs in my district, and we have a plant that manufactures a part that they use on those tanks, and if they don't need any more tanks, 500 people in my district are going to be laid off, so I don't want them laid off, plus that tank company gives me money. So let's keep the tanks, whether or not the military wants them, and then let's have a foreign policy, maybe, that understands that we might need to use these tanks. After all, if you don't have a foreign policy that needs to use the tanks, after a while people start saying, why are we spending all this taxpayer dollar on tanks? And then you get into an argument, and Sherry gets into this in his book a little bit, that maybe you could call military Keynesianism the idea, and this is how it kind of goes, and it's not a conspiracy theory type thing. There's nothing submerged about it. It's talked about in the highest circles of government openly. But it's the question, after the Second World War, when it was perceived on the part of a lot of people that after a decade of trying everything you could think of to get the United States out of the worst economic times maybe it's ever had in its history, times where some people suggested the form of government was in danger if it couldn't figure out a way out of the Depression, the war got the United States out of the Depression because of massive amounts of military spending. And as the war began to wind down, there were voices in government wondering, okay, well, what does that mean for our economy? I mean, they were traumatized by the Great Depression, and all of a sudden the thing that all of them knew got them out of the Great Depression was going to go away. What would happen when that happened? Were we going to have a return to that? And if that's what we face, isn't anything worth not having that happen? I mean, people will talk about the Marshall Plan as saving a bunch of different European countries from falling to communism because of all this U.S. aid. But let's be honest, U.S. companies needed to, you know, make stuff for the Marshall Plan, too. It wasn't exactly a one-way deal. A lot of people in this country gained from that. And when we ramped up spending again in the Cold War, very shortly after the Second World War, there were a lot of people who felt like this was a huge shot in the arm for the U.S. economy, and a shot in the arm which, by the way, continues to pay off. I challenge you to go find out how many entities in our civil society around us benefit greatly from the foreign policy and the military spending. Do you know your favorite university probably does? A lot of military spending in research and a lot of universities working on projects that one way or another are tied to defense needs. When Eisenhower gave his famous military-industrial complex speech, one of the things he's talking about in that is you begin to create people who see opportunities in the defense climate. And that's only natural. There's nothing sinister about that. You know, after 9/11, if you decide, hey, I'm going to start a security company because I see a growing need for security, that's just opportunity knocking, isn't it? You'd be a bad American if you didn't take advantage of the potential of that kind of a business chance right there. Here's the problem. Let's say that security fears and needs begin to ebb over time. Is it in your interest for your local representative and the jobs you provide in his district to allow security or the mood that creates the tension that fuels the need and desire for more security? Is it in his interest or your interest to let tensions diminish? This is how you begin to develop a whole lot of people who have a lot invested in continuing to do things the way they are. We have a defense policy with the U.S. as the spider in the center of the web that's been going on for 50 years, and a lot of people depend on that for a lot of money. And it goes from, you know, CEOs that make bazillions of dollars to shareholders that invest in these companies to workers who feed their families with really good upper middle class jobs that are still one of the, I mean, one of the great things America still does is make weaponry. And one of the best places to buy our weaponry is our military. Obviously, we sell it to lots of other people too, but I mean, when you're buying more tanks than your military even wants, it's a sign that that's a business decision, not a what do we need to fight the war decision. I think if a businessman like Trump looks at this situation and concludes that that's the tail wagging the dog in terms of how you should be operating with the public's money, that would be a good thing. I think if he even prompts an active debate on the question, that's a good thing. To me, that's just common sense. That's neo-prudentist foreign policy thinking as I see it, right? I think it's worth pointing out, too, how, and I think this is a symptom of all long-running government entities and agencies, and I look at something like NATO as similar in terms of the dynamic that governs how it operates, but they get founded and have a, you know, structure from the ground up based on conditions that were in operation at the time of their founding. But those conditions change over time. If you look at something like a NATO, look at the various unwritten understandings that are built into it, the way it's designed. NATO is, of course, a military alliance, right? At ground level. It's an alliance that is built on a reality that existed at the end of the Second World War and the beginning of the Cold War. That reality was that what is now the Russian Federation was a much larger nation, had a bunch of other mostly captive nations with it, known as the Warsaw Pact, most of them, nations that are now like Poland and what was East Germany and the Czech Republic and Hungary and all those places. And what was called the Red Army was the most powerful land army in the world. And there were very real fears that if it decided it wanted to, starting from somewhere in Central Europe, they could roll over Central Europe all the way through France to the Atlantic Ocean and do so quickly. On the other side, you had NATO, the Warsaw Pact on one side, NATO on the other. NATO had other advantages, much better air force, much better navy, really the only surface fleet, and nuclear weapons that they, for a very long time, had plans to use in worst-case scenarios if the Red Army steamrolled and overwhelmed, you know, NATO forces. Now, NATO forces were always presumed to be qualitatively better, but it was understood that you were going to be outnumbered and maybe outgunned, and there were a lot of tanks. The Russians based their whole defense structure on the ground on massive use of armor, and it was scary. And so you have an alliance system here based on the idea that it's going to take just about everything you have to hold off the Red Army if the Red Army one day decides to, you know, stream through the Fulda Gap and head toward Germany. So when NATO's formed, that's the reality, and you can see it in the very structure, right? The very seed that's planted at ground zero, the framework that holds the whole edifice up is a framework built and designed for that reality. Fast forward to now. The GDP of the Russian Federation is less than Italy's. Italy's alone. Maybe the biggest land power on paper, but Italy's got a bigger GDP than you do. In terms of population, about 140-some million people and falling. That's just a little bit more than the UK and France put together right now. You add Germany to the scales, and the Russian Federation is significantly outnumbered in terms of population. And they're crushed in terms of GDP. This is a continent that is prosperous and capable. What's more, you know, when we were afraid of the old Soviet Union, they had countries on their side, unwillingly mostly, who are now on the other side. If the Russians are the main reason NATO is really important right now with the resurgence of Putin and the bear is on the move again and all that kind of stuff, the bear doesn't have Poland this time, and I can't think of anyone who'd be more anti-Russian than they. Unless, of course, it was the Hungarians who are now on the other side, too. or the East Germans, who don't exist anymore because they're now a part of a united Germany that has some 85 million people of its own and an economy much larger than the Russian Federation's. I think you catch my drift here. I'm not even mentioning all the other European countries you could add to the scale here. I guess my point is, the European countries, just most of them, taken on their own, have a lot of latent power. Now, there are obviously reasons, and we've been talking about them this whole show, why that power is latent as opposed to manifest. If you're a European politician, I think you're just being a neo-prudentist and using common sense when you decide, heck no, I'm not going to build up the Polish Navy right now. Our kids need schools, or we need more healthcare dollars, or whatever it's going to be. I'm going to spend the money on that because, after all, there's a U.S. Navy, and really, it's a moot point, right? So I get it, but you can't hide from me, Europe. I'm watching something, and I have a nice little smile on my face, which shows that I'm just twisted and I'm weird. But when I'm watching this tragedy, let's on all sides, unfold as people flee North Africa and places like Syria and often drown while crossing the Mediterranean and the Aegean trying to get to safety, and the people there are trying to deal with, you know, mass influx of people from different cultures who are poor. I mean, you know, it's a global human tragedy. But there are little things that still, you know, I can get a little kick out of. And one of the things is I'm getting a kick out of watching some of these European navies getting a good workout and seemingly, I think, more muscular in the process. Little exercise is good. And I'm watching these navies. I mean, you look at the Italian Navy as a perfect example. And I'm seeing them get better. I'm seeing them evolve almost naturally. You know, I mean, as you begin to do tasks more often, you just get better at them, and you figure out little quirks and hacks and stuff all the time to improve the situation, and over a period of time, you get significantly more capable. That's just normal. In military history, that happens all the time, but you're watching several of Europe's navies getting really darn good, and, I mean, you know, just significantly improved, and you begin in your head to go, they could do this, and what's more, it'd be good for them, and it'd be good for the United States, too. It'd be good in the sense, folks, that it would be nice to have more centers of capability, people that could help when situations nearby demand it. I mean, you try to look at a global framework that could replace something like the U.S. spider in the center of the web, and you start thinking maybe instead of a centralized kind of an authority, maybe nodes of operation. As I said, volunteer fire departments, maybe, and we have people who are capable all over the world. And I don't mean to denigrate, for example, the capability of the UK or France. They often put troops and support them over long distances. But even they would have to step up their game to a higher level. But they're capable of it. And why shouldn't they be the ones who handle problems that are in places where it's natural to call on them? Why should the US be the one with the only fire hose and the only fire hydrant? Like many of you, I've given up on the idea that the UN peacekeepers, you know, can ever be put in situations where we really think we need security as opposed to having people just sort of form a human barrier between these two warring parties. But if you had something happen in New Guinea, for example, and the UN basically said, listen, we have no power to make you, but the world would like the Australian Navy and Army to quickly intervene in New Guinea to prevent a million people from getting their heads hacked off. Would you please help, you know, for the next month? I think most powers would probably go, oh, you mean me? Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, of course, the Australian Navy's always been willing to help, and I got news for you. If you tell me I have a bunch of blue-helmeted Swedish UN guys, maybe, that I need to be afraid of in this area if I get all uppity, I'm not all that scared given the track record. I wouldn't mess with a bunch of Australian soldiers. I'm just saying. So maybe right there we begin to see something that I think U.S. policy has taken into account for a long time, which is these ideas of leagues of nations and United Nations and all those things are kind of pie in the sky unless you have an enforcement arm. And the enforcement arm, you know, that the people who designed these agencies kind of assumed would exist doesn't exist. The only thing that exists that's like it is the United States, who's like Woodrow Wilson combined with Rambo, right? That's who enforces the United Nations policies, even if the United Nations isn't totally behind us thinking that this is their policy. And sometimes when they do have policies that we don't like, we don't enforce them. But by and large, if you get in trouble with the UN, you might have to deal with us. How's that for enough disclaimers there? Richard Nixon had a program during the Vietnam War when he was trying to figure out how to disengage from that. And as we've said many times on the program, and as all you military people already know, and also all you military historian people already know, I mean, the hardest thing to do in warfare, from a tactical level to a grand strategy level, is disengage from contact. And how do you pull back, right? And in Vietnam, the plan that Richard Nixon had was to slowly but surely allow our South Vietnamese allies to take over more of the burden and slowly but surely help them to increase their capabilities so that they could do that, as opposed to just saying, hey, bye, hope it all works out. The terminology of the time was to expand, equipped, and train the South Vietnamese forces and assign to them an ever-increasing combat role, at the same time steadily reducing the number of U.S. combat troops, right? End quote. Okay. Why is that such a bad model for a NATO without the U.S. as actively involved sort of approach? I mean, couldn't you say that a Europe as powerful and prosperous as it is now would be able to handle a much more self-contained role, as long as we all decided that's what they should do and slowly but surely allowed them to do it? I like what I see in terms of their capability in the Mediterranean. That's only going to get better. Give them some more ships. That's only going to get more efficient and the capabilities expand. Give them a little power projection and supply ability. Again, it'd be a wonder what they might be able to do as one of the volunteer fire departments in that part of the world, right? For global security, collective security as it was originally envisioned. Here's the problem. If you're a European country, you're sitting there going, wait a minute, Dan, listen, I like your idea, and I'm a proud Italian, for example, and it sounds all good, but do you realize what budgetary problems we have right now, Dan? I mean, it's really not a good time for us to buy a couple of new Navy ships. I mean, come on, and let's be realistic here. Fiscally, your idea, Dan, doesn't make a lot of sense for Italians. Here's where we have maybe our little disagreement. What Trump is playing into and what Bernie Sanders was playing into when he talks about his military reform and what all these other third-party candidates are playing into is a two-pronged approach. Prong number one is we can't afford it either. Prong number two is when we do act in these kind of capacities, we end up more often than not in a situation that's worse than what we set out to fix. You add those two things together, and doesn't it sort of, I mean, wouldn't common sense dictate that you would take a look at things? Can't continue to afford it, not really working out so well anyway in terms of results. Let's keep doing that or you're an isolationist? See how that just drives me crazy, folks? Now, there's another possibility, and the other possibility is like a zero-based budgeting approach to a NATO, where you turn around and say, listen, it's 50 years later and the situation's a whole lot different than when we started this thing, so let's start it over. And let's look at everything with a white sheet of paper in front of it and start from scratch. If we were building NATO today, based on today's conditions, how would we do it? And I know what you're thinking, because everybody who's involved in this kind of stuff thinks the same thing. Dan, that is crazy. Do you know how much and how integrated and how complex and how, you know, this is 50 years of structure that you're just talking about going in and ripping apart and zero-based budgeting with? But that's exactly my point, folks. Your point about why we can't do it is my argument about why we need to. And I just think if you get yourself locked into this idea that you can't change really long-running and complex structures because they're long-running and complex, well, then you lock yourself into an inability to evolve and to get better. And you also lock yourself into situations that aren't working for you, but you can't envision any other sort of reality. I mean, let's get back to the idea of what we're getting and what foreign policy should really be about. Should foreign policy be about maintaining the economy because having an active military is good for business? Should it be about maintaining our ability to have petrochemicals shipped from one part of the world to our allies in other parts of the world or to ourselves? I mean, have a discussion over what it is you would be willing to use a military for and what a foreign policy should be about. And then you can begin to ask yourself whether or not we're getting the results we want. If you say, listen, Dan, let's not be naive. There's an economic component to this. And if you believed in 1945 that going back to a peacetime economy would bring the Great Depression back with a vengeance, then you saved the country in its most prosperous period in U.S. history, the post-Second World War era, by continuing wartime production. Then maybe you say the U.S. foreign policy goal is to keep the U.S. economy running. But isn't that a little like saying you have this socialist program that puts dollars into things we don't need because it's good to have those dollars out there circulating, the government spending your tax dollars on stuff we don't need that does enrich some businesses, of course, and shareholders. There's a circular element to the money once they put it in play, right? It helps lots of people, including people in aero defense jobs and government research universities who are working on this stuff. I mean, there's a trickle-down effect to military dollars, but is that a good enough reason to structure your foreign policy as interventionist? We need an interventionist foreign policy because it's the only way we can keep the economy running. Seems to me that that's a tail wagging the dog myself. But if you're saying that we need these kinds of foreign policies to expand U.S. interest and defend ourselves, then I think you again have a legitimate question here about effectiveness. And when you argue with people, let me tell you how the argument breaks down every time. Every time you get into hypotheticals. And I understand why. Because if you're saying that our foreign policy is not working to our advantage, you point to the world as it is right now. If you're trying to make the opposite argument, you point to the world that maybe was averted because of the approach that was taken. So I'll have this discussion with people and they'll say, Dan, it's my contention that the entire U.S. domination of, you know, NATO and Western foreign policy since the Second World War prevented World War III. Hundreds of millions of lives could have been lost. If that's the case, it justifies everything that's happened since. Very hard to argue against that, isn't it? The argument that I would give is that things we do to make things better often make things worse. And when they make things worse, sometimes the people that are worse off look at us as the bad guys. Americans, and I'm amongst them, we think of ourselves as trying to help. Nothing is more shocking to us than when we spend money and lives trying to help and things go wrong and then people hold us in contempt for that. And you think to yourself, well, I was trying to help. I didn't have to come over there and topple your dictator for you. Just trying to help. We helped the French in the Second World War, after all. And you think like that sometimes, and those endeavors are often sold to the American people that way. But you get rid of a Saddam Hussein because he's the next coming of Hitler and all these kinds of things, and he's probably developing nuclear weapons, and I mean, we all remember how it went. Things will be better for the Iraqi people, and they'll vote, and they won't be tortured anymore, and the bombings will stop, and blah, 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 and look at where we are. And of course, listen, anybody can make a mistake. If Iraq were the only thing that we'd gotten wrong in this whole deal, I think you just chalk that up to the idea that, you know, no one's perfect. But I think we all know it's incident after incident after incident. How many foreign policy backfires and mistakes and botched implementations do you have to have before somebody backs up and says, listen, let's stop looking at all of these incidents on a case-by-case basis, and let's examine the overarching policy that gets us into these kinds of situations to begin with. And while I know that these elites, these opinion makers and all this, think they know better than the general public, and they certainly spend more time studying the issue, and they talk to the opinion makers behind the scenes and all these kinds of things, I think they also have more invested in opinions they've taken before. It's harder for them to change their mind when they have decades of columns and opinions and things that they've said that they would have to literally oppose their own work if they wanted to change their minds on this stuff. Harder for somebody that invested to decide they don't like a policy that they've spent years defending. The general public often doesn't have that level of commitment to failed policies. A lot of times they're able to look at things, you know, with a lot less invested in it and just sort of say, how's this working out for us? As I said earlier, if you actually sat down and had a national conversation amongst what sort of foreign policy would most aid the needs, desires, and choices that average Americans would make about what they wanted their country to do, how different would it be from the one we have now? If you didn't have a country where campaign money, for example, from all these interests played such an important role, if the legislators were actually reflecting the will of the people, how different would our foreign policy be than it is today? And I ask this because I'm going to make an assumption here, and the assumption is that there is some level of support you must have on the part of the population for the foreign policy, or it will collapse. I don't know what that number is. You might even be able to make a case that you could keep your foreign policy going as long as the elites want it to go that way and a decent amount of your population does. Maybe only 30% has to support it. But I think what this Trump election helps show, and I think it does on the Bernie Sanders side too, is that, you know, the question of changing the foreign policy is becoming more and more important to American voters. How much of an ability do they have to sway that? And I don't think we know the answer to that either. I will say that there's nothing you can do in terms of taxes, because people have tried for a long time to say, I'm not going to pay my taxes because you use it for war and I won't be a party to that. And then they go right to jail. I also don't think that voting for candidates is necessarily all you need to do, because first of all, people have been voting for these third party and independent candidates forever and not getting them elected. And we've had Republicans and Democrats promising to change the foreign policy. How many of you remember George W. Bush in 2000 running on a platform where he was pushing what was called a more humble foreign policy? But those politicians tend to forget those things very quickly. I think there's a lot of Trump supporters that hope that because he's not a politician, he'll remember this promise and carry it out. And remember, being a president, he has a lot of ability in the foreign policy realm. I mean, if he's looking for one issue, he doesn't have to ask a lot of favors from other branches of government to get done. You would think it would be this. If I had to bet money on it, I'd bet that if he gets elected, he forgets this promise. I don't think he'll follow it through. I don't think he'll follow a lot of promises through. That's just my own opinion. But as we've already established in this show, I've been wrong about this guy before. I'm not a fan, but I have to say that some of these things that are coming to the fore, the foreign policy question, I would have just liked Bernie Sanders to have done better too for the same reason. I would love to have Hillary Clinton have to answer some of this stuff too about the foreign policy, because I think she ends up looking like a defender of the same framework that has created mistake after mistake after mistake, backfire after backfire after backfire, and unintended consequence after unintended consequence. What happens if the people don't support this anymore at the boots on the ground level? You know, earlier I had said that I thought that Trump becoming president was inconceivable. I think changing the foreign policy is pretty darn inconceivable too. But sometimes things happen that create the conditions where things have to change. I mean, when a 9/11 happens, things change, right? All of a sudden, a whole bunch of things that seemed impossible the day before all of a sudden become possible because circumstances have been altered radically. If we can't get enough soldiers to support this foreign policy, think about how much that might change it overnight. And listen, I have a friend who maybe you could say has free market economics as his religion, who will argue that things like getting enough soldiers in a volunteer military is simply a question of price point, that as long as you're willing to pay what it takes, you'll get all the soldiers you need. And maybe he's right. But I'll tell you what, right now, folks, we're not sending the same soldiers back to places like Afghanistan and Iraq and everything else over and over and over again because we want to see their sweet, familiar, smiling faces. We're sending them back utilizing things like the stop-loss clause in their contracts and whatnot because we can't get new people to take their place, not in large enough numbers for the mission to continue. When I was at the CENTCOM meeting back a couple of years ago and I was listening to generals and admirals and people in the U.S. bureaucracy talk about, you know, what the future looks like when budgetary crunch time comes, they were talking about Americans having to make choices between much-loved entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare and the costs of supporting our foreign policy framework here. And their position at the time was, you know, if you ask Americans what has to go, the policemen of the world foreign policy or trimming Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, they think that the American people are going to say, ditch that foreign policy. Again, finances may make this a sustainability question, and all of a sudden, things that are inconceivable to us right now become things that all of a sudden are possible to envision. We may be entering, folks, a time where in the very near future, events will create maybe what you could call a catalyst for the inconceivable. Donald Trump himself may be a catalyst for the inconceivable. But if U.S. foreign policy continues to be something more and more Americans either disagree with or don't agree with enough to support in any way that requires sacrifice in either dollars or their children's lives or health, I would find it difficult to imagine that we could continue to do it. I do think it's an interesting experiment either way, though. Wouldn't it be interesting to see how the United States maintains this foreign policy if most Americans, the vast majority of Americans, don't support it? Be an interesting kind of country right there, wouldn't it?
I would find it difficult to imagine that we could continue to do it. Now, one of the same friends I've already quoted in this show would say, well, listen, Dan, you know, there are ways around that. I mean, if the support for the foreign policy dips too low, you know, all that has to happen is one good world crisis, and you'll watch American interventionist sentiment skyrocket as it always does. If you have a 9/11, if Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait, I mean, you know how it works. Those things happen. The Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor, and everybody will be ready to intervene. You just wait. The American public's mood on these things is fluid. All those things may be true. But before you think that, like so much of the stuff we talked about in this show that a year and a half ago would have been esoteric, what-if, philosophical discussions with no basis in realism, discussing what we might do if all of a sudden disaster strikes in a place like Iraq may be a lot less theoretical than we think. Those of you who pay attention to the news know that last week a powerful Shiite cleric in Iraq launched a takeover. I don't know how to describe this best. I've heard several different descriptions, but launched a takeover of part of the Green Zone. And essentially, it was more of a reminder of his power personally, but also to all these people that have taken their eyes off Iraq temporarily to focus on other things, to remember that, wait a minute, not only is Iraq not settled, Iraq is very unstable indeed. We Americans often don't notice what's going on over there, but even those of you who are well-informed, you know, you take the front section of your morning paper and you're near the couple of last back pages and maybe you happen to notice one day there'll be a little notation in the paper, you know, Baghdad bombing, 23 people dead. A couple days later, you know, bombing in Iraq, 35 people killed, 75 wounded. And if you notice and you start adding those up, you'll notice that they're happening on a regular basis. And you start to understand that if you were living in that environment, every time that happens, the pressure's being ratcheted up. And eventually, like straws on the camel's back, right, that proverb, eventually something's going to break. And that takeover by Shiites of that territory in the Green Zone or whatever it was is a reminder of how quickly that could happen. And remember, those of you old enough to know, how often do we wake up to these events that are moving so fast you don't even know how to respond? When Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait before the first Gulf War, I mean, he did it overnight. We woke up to CNN showing the Iraqi army in Kuwait looting. Imagine something like that happens 4 or 5 days before this November's election, right? Talk about catching you off guard. It's a Murphy's Law thing, and Murphy's Law and history seem to work pretty well together. But when something like that happens, you're going to be talking and hear talk from guys like Charles Krauthammer, among others, about a new surge. Need to send in 25 to 50,000 guys, quell that situation, increase stability, you know, drive back insurgents, you know, create safe zones, fill in the gap. Where are those people going to come from, folks? And how often can you continue to scrape these people up as needed, as opposed to having some sort of policy that we can, over the long haul, support? Look at the country's finances. I hear from a lot of people that say you don't have to worry about finances. Things like, you know, the fact that the U.S. dollar is the global reserve currency, things like that, Dan, make the United States in a unique position to not have to pay attention to the same sort of fiscal responsibilities that would bring other countries' efforts to a grinding halt. The U.S. doesn't have to worry about that stuff. Well, we'll see, won't we? Meanwhile, apparently more and more Americans are voting for candidates that promise to change the foreign policy for them, and fewer of them seem to be signing up for any sort of duty that would put their boots on the ground to be the people at ground zero who have to be available for this foreign policy of ours where we're the policemen of the world to work. You need policemen. So it seems you have two basic questions here. One is the U.S. foreign policy, where the U.S. is cast in the role of policeman of the world, sustainable? Is it permanent? And if it's not, when does it end and how does it end? There was a famous economic advisor for Richard Nixon named Herbert Stein. And he coined something called Stein's Law, or Herbert Stein's Law, where he said, if something cannot go on forever,
it will stop. Can the U.S. play the role of policeman of the world forever? I mean, is this a permanent thing? When we talk about NATO and all these things and we say you can't change it because it's more than 50 years of ingrained structure and foundation and roots that are planted very deeply, does this make us think that this is something that's going to be around 500 years from now? Or is there some time where NATO and the defense structure we have right now won't be around? And if so, was that something that happened because we chose to do something different? Or is it something that happened because, as Herbert Stein once said, if something cannot go on forever, it will stop? Does it make sense to have this stop when we don't want it to stop because we either can't pay for it or we can't find the people to make up the boots on the ground that are integral to it working? Or would it be better to address this before you get to such dire straits, when you still have choice and flexibility and perhaps multiple choices and options on ways to do this, and figure out a decent way to break contact in this case? You know, another word you might use is soft landing. When we talk about, for example, the Chinese government trying to have a soft landing from communism, the British government, you know, after the end of the Second World War, trying to have a soft landing from empire. How does the United States have a soft landing that allows us to decouple from our responsibilities as the spider in the center of the web? Well, we can talk about that someday, as soon as we get to the point where we've finished having the discussion about whether or not that's something we should even be contemplating. As I've told you before, I'm no Donald Trump fan, but because of how well he's doing, this becomes the first time we've had a logical, realistic, you know, moment where we could say, might be a good time to talk about these things, because if Donald Trump actually becomes president and follows through with his promises, we may be looking at this soft landing from the policeman of the world position sooner than anyone thought. Seems a little inconceivable, doesn't it? But as we said, maybe events and trends and forces moving the way that they are acting as a bit of a catalyst for the inconceivable. Audible is the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment. Sometimes that means audiobooks, but there's a whole lot more, as we've said before. Right now, there are over 180,000 individual offerings, and that's a number that's growing all the time. Programs that are provided by, you know, leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, business information providers, includes old-time radio shows, comedy bits, magazine articles, greatest speeches in history. There's something for everybody on Audible. And I have to admit, it sometimes gets me into trouble. I'm often, you know, forced to wonder whether Audible's entire reason for sponsoring this program is simply because they're sucking me into so many book purchases. It might be a monstrous scam here. I'm starting to feel like one of those local bands that shows up to play at the local tavern, and at the end of the night when they go to get paid, once the band's bar tab is deducted from, you know, their pay, they end up owing the tavern owner money. Thanks, Audible. Because every time I look for a book to recommend to you on Audible, you know, and I always search for ones I've read so that I can give you an honest sort of a recommendation, I find a bunch of books I haven't read yet that grab and hold me. I mean, if you've got almost 200,000 titles, that could happen to you. And then so along the way to recommending a book to you, Audible gets me for a couple of new ones themselves. I mean, I'll give you two right here that I couldn't resist. One I really should have. I shouldn't have probably gotten Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam by Nick Turse. And the reason why is I was reading the reviews, and they can be so white-hot, five-star, one-star, veterans mad at other veterans. I mean, it's just one of those things where once I read the reviews, I'm like, well, I have to see what all the fuss is about. And I went and did some online research, and there's lots of fussing involved in this, and so it sucked me in like a, you know, military history fans magazine or something. I have to see what the fuss is about. So I'm picking that up. Got me there, Audible. There's another one on a subject I can't resist. This one's called Exercising Hitler, The Occupation and Denazification of Germany by Frederick Taylor. I just read a book about this same situation in Japan, where after the war they have to sort of deprogram or reprogram the population to make them able to govern themselves after a period where, you know, things have been rather traumatic, to say the least. I've read stuff on the Nazi Germany version of this before. I stumbled along this looking for a book to recommend to you, and I'm hooked. Books have a way of doing that, don't they? Which is why I want to warn you before I tell you that if you go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin right now, you can get a free 30-day trial. And that's great, but be careful. You could get sucked in like I'm sucked in, and then what do? And Audible has ways to keep you even hooked and make the experience even more addicting. How about their app that they provide now? It includes chapter navigation, annotated bookmarks, a sleep mode. This is a really cool feature. A narration speed control, where you can control how quickly or how slowly it's narrated. I hear there's a bunch of you that do this with my show already. And I've heard from some of you that I sound better at 45 speed than the whatever the natural one is. There's a 30-second rewind, a button-free mode. There's even something you can get involved in called a great listener guarantee, where if you don't like the book you choose, you can return it for a new one. That's worth looking into. And if this all sounds good to you, well, why don't you go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin and get your free 30-day trial.
If you think the show you just heard was worth a dollar, then cough it up. Nonpartisanism doesn't attract the big donors, you know. And hey, you Europeans and Pacific Rim people, yeah, I'm looking at you, Australia. You people are just as susceptible to guilt as everyone else. So put a little shrimp on the barbie for Dan and Ben, because we know where you live. In Australia.